So we've been going over Ecclesiastes, and as Pastor Joe's mentioned, how interesting, and one of the favorite books of his. It's also one of my favorite, in part because it deals with some of the corners of life. It deals with some of the stuff in life that's on the edges and on the fringes, right? So most of Scripture, and when you even think of wisdom literature, there's a sense in which it's very practical, it makes sense, it's very traditional, right? You reap what you sow. And that makes sense. And actually, 99% of the time, or, you know, maybe it's 90% of the time, or 75% of the time, however much the statistic actually is, most often than not, that wisdom is going to play itself out in that way. However, there's these nasty little corners of life in which, if truth be told, wisdom doesn't play in that way. It doesn't actually manifest itself in that way. And so the expectations that we have, those that we place, and then we invest and pour our life into that, I want to sow this and sow this and sow this so that I can reap this. But sometimes what happens is all the sowing and all that stuff, and then all of a sudden I find that I'm reaping something other than what I expected. And the danger as Christians and even as people is that we live life and we live out those practical principles of life that are found in traditional proverbs and traditional wisdom. We live those out in a way that's a universal principle, right? That always has to happen. Every time I plant one kernel of corn, I am going to get one stalk of corn, right? You know, even when we were taught early on to, you always, not we, but as a nation, to put the fish and then the kernels of corn. You put several kernels of corn in because you don't know, right? And so it's better to kind of invest more knowing that that investment there is going to reap a much larger reward. So even in that sense, there's truth to be told. But the challenge is that if I embrace that as a universal principle or a universal truth rather than a principle, is that I'm going to get discouraged or even despair when it doesn't play out in the way that I planned. And so Ecclesiastes in many ways is that what happens when if I have everything at my disposal as a king and I invest and I build and I do all of this stuff, and then I realize all of that building and all of that stuff that I invested my life into, whether it was building or whether it was money or whether it was pleasure or whether it was fame, all of that stuff, eventually it doesn't fill the hole inside of me. It doesn't fill that eternity that God placed in our hearts. As it says in Ecclesiastes 3:11, is that God placed eternity in our hearts. So that as we try to fill it with stuff that this finite world, this material world could that we think is going to satisfy, we'd realize, nope, that doesn't satisfy me. And as you've been working, hopefully, on the verse for this month, Ecclesiastes 4:6, which is, it says, better is one handful of quiet than two hands full of toil, right? And a grasping after the wind. Now, there's this grasping after the wind that Solomon is really emphasizing, and he says it in this way, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Right? But in the original, the idea was not just vanity, but it was meaninglessness, all is meaninglessness. And so in some of your translations, you might have that word, meaninglessness. Some of you might have vanity. But even more so, it's this concept of vapor. Is that there's this? So even in that phrase that he says early on, there's this grasping, right? In that verse that we are working on, is that there's actually, that's what life is, right? That's what life is. We drink the cup of coffee, but really it's just a vapor. How many of you remember the first cup of coffee you ever drank? Right? Some of you may, because you're younger and you're like, oh, it was nasty. Do some of you remember that, right? Does that still satisfy your craving for coffee? No. Like, I even remember this morning when I drank coffee, I'm like, oh, I need some more. Like, I still need. Why? Because it's a grasping, right? I needed two handfuls of coffee of Starbucks, and I only had one, but it's going to be quiet. So part of life and really helping gain a sense of wisdom that's going to handle the storm of your life and all of those nasty little corners of life that don't make sense is recognizing my wisdom, my perspective and my understanding of life needs to incorporate even that. Like, if it doesn't, then I'm going to get blindsided by life. I'm going to get shipwrecked by life. If I just think, okay, God has given me a universal truth here. Now, he has given us universal truths. But one of those truths is found in Ecclesiastes, which is sometimes life doesn't make sense. Sometimes all of the pursuits of your life, when you get it, it doesn't satisfy as you thought it would. And that's pointing to something more, right? That points to the eternity in our heart. And actually, what that points to is the fact that we were made for a relationship with the eternal God. Right? Even though we are stuck in flesh and bone, and that flesh comes out of the womb, and then it has all this energy, and then it just keeps going, and you get to this phase where then you start to slow down a little bit, right? And you start to realize, okay, life is wearing down on me. My brother and I just bought a weight set because, like, I'm starting to realize I actually need to be intentional about that. I'm becoming a weak man, and I still am. But it doesn't matter if it just stays in our basement and I don't use it, right? So there's that recognition in life of okay, I need these components. I need this wisdom in my life. I need this to make sense and sort out some of that stuff. But then I actually need to do the work. I got down there and started weightlifting. I was like, oh, and I could feel it just about in everyone. I'm like, no, I don't like that. That's not healthy, right? But it is. I just don't realize in the moment. And that's also true since we have this whole concept is also true with children, with little babies, all right? When the littlest Joe Parkinson came out, imagine that. His whole life experience up to that point, right, was comfort, and there was a lot of wisdom. It made sense, right? He just kind of hung out and would move around sometimes if he felt a little like he needed to stretch. But then, you know, and then mom would oblige and kind of like, you know, move the kidney over or whatever it was, you know, and he would just do his thing. But then you can imagine when he came out how startling different the world was, right? Totally different than inside the womb. And most of us don't remember inside the womb because we've gotten used to life. But little Joe P, he still remembers that, you know. And so I imagine maybe that's the reason why, you know, he gets, you know, can get a little frustrated. My two nephews from my sister had two radically different experiences when they came out of the womb. The first came out, and he was angry at the world. Right when he came out, I mean, it was like, and he just wouldn't stop, right? And then the other one, Jack, he's the youngest, he came out, and he's like, all right, okay. Not even crying. And then the nurse was like scrubbing him down and cleaning him. I was like, okay. You know, where it was amazing. And Jack is really tough, but Andrew is very, he's very tied into justice. Everything needs to be just, or his version. He still is understanding those things. So for him, it's fascinating. He was a baby. He actually recognized that. Like, this is not just, right? What did you just do? I just went through this crazy experience, and now I'm in a cold world. Like, no, I don't like that. That's not right. And life has those components, and we have to, as we live life, we have to recognize that, okay, how do I include all the aspects of life so that I can handle the things that come down the path, right? How can I deal with those things so that I can have that handful of quiet instead of two hands full of toil, right? And that's going to, there's an art to that. You see, I've been watching some shows on modern houses and all the different amazing houses that people build. And I was imagining, okay, this is what Solomon was up to, right? He didn't just need a house, he already built a house, right? I'm still kind of working on remodeling my one house, right? But he had all these other houses, and these other people say, I'm going to spend an obscene amount of money on this vacation home that I'm going to go for a couple months out of the year, and they're incredible. They're not just houses, they're like pieces of art, you know? And I don't know if you can actually call that a house. I didn't really like it, but it's pretty amazing, and I just thought that's a little bit what Solomon is doing, and that's in many ways a first world problem, as Steve mentioned, you know, is that there are these problems that we face because we are affluent and we have certain things, and so we face those in a different way than the third world faces. And so Solomon is facing certain problems that are more like first world problems, right? What happens when you achieve your dream and you realize it's not going to satisfy you in a lasting way? What happens when you win the Super Bowl and you realize winning another Super Bowl is fine, but I've reached the pinnacle of my career? You know, there's a sense of despair that can come with that, and Solomon speaks to that in his book, right? There's inherent blessings to being in a first world country, although increasingly, even in the third world, you will have one of these things. It's a blessing, right? Mm-hmm. Some of you remember the day when the cell phones were massive, right? You had a backpack. I mean, that was the original one, right? You had a backpack that went with your cell phone. Then they had the flip top, right? And with that came that T9 language, right? So some of you, even though you do use the T9 language, that's what it's called, right? OMG, LOL. By the way, OMG, just as a side note, that's blasphemy, all right? I'm just going to say, right? We know it's a little, so there's that language that comes from the flip phone, but it just carried over, right? Because it's just easy, even though I can now speak those words. I could actually laugh out loud and record it, but no, I write LOL, right? Or some people even say it, right? So they're not even, they're in a conversation with someone like LOL, you know? So it's not even a term anymore for what is it meant. It's actually taken on a life of its own. But there are blessings in this. There's texting, and I can blog, and I can call people. And so there's this way in which this speeds up communication. And that's a huge blessing. But there's also, it can be a curse, because with the blogging and texting and Instagramming and all of that, there's also trolling, right? And then there's doxing, you know, and all of that. And the other day, actually it was yesterday, I was reading an article by someone who, this is in the article she said this: there are four little words in the English language that are sure to annoy anyone on your contact list. And that is the four words, sent from my iPhone. Right? That's what was her premise, right? And so I thought, that's interesting, because I don't really care. Like, by the time I've read that message, I've read the good stuff. And at the end, it's irrelevant to me. But apparently to some people, this is very annoying, right? She probably was born coming out like screaming, right? You know, like, annoying, sent from my iPhone. But listen to this there, and we'll advance the slide, I think at least once or twice. Maybe advances. There we go. All right. So here is a tweet. For those that don't know, that's when you use the Twitter. It's called a tweet instead of tweeted. And she says here, this is someone else. She's just recording it. The rudest words in the English language. Okay. Number one. Number two, huh. And number three, sent from my iPhone. And I thought about that for a second. I thought, really? So the three rudest words in the English language are the letter K. There's another word that's like four letters down that we refer to just by its letter. That's a little bit ruder than K, all right, if you know what I'm saying. All right, do the math. Number two, huh? Three letters, okay, but there are so many four-letter words, right, that are a lot ruder, more rude, however the proper way of saying that is, and then sent from my iPhone. So usually what happens in that context is someone puts out their thought and then it gets responded to, right? So there's a blog, there's a thought, and then there's responses to that. So go to the next one. This might be a variation of trolling. My dudes, I just finished my entire section of the group project and signed it off with sent from my iPhone. Go to the next one. Sometimes when I end an email, I manually type sent from my iPhone to make it seem like I actually get out of the office every now and then. You know, so in some ways you start to see how even this world here allows me to create my own reality, right? Or to impress someone with something else that's not actually true. But maybe he also is just trolling. And then there's the irony of the last post, which is everyone just needs to get off their phones. Sent from my iPhone, right? And there's a beauty of that, but really the truth is that we can appreciate some of the detail in the English language. We can appreciate the fact that there are reasons why we use periods and commas and question marks and stuff. Have you ever received a text message and you don't know? I mean, all of you have received the ones where it's autocorrected and you can't figure out what it autocorrected. Like, I don't even know what's going on. Like, but you know, and so there's sometimes that frustration, but then my brother has a habit of sending me questions, but he doesn't put a question mark. And then I have to figure out if it's a question or a statement. I don't know, right? So instead of like adding a period or a question mark, by the way, you can double tap space and it puts a period in most phones. But if you're sending me messages, please help me out here. I don't want to have to ask for your forgiveness later. But Barry, I'll have to figure out if it's a question mark, you know, a question or not, because he didn't put the question. So then I have to do extra work, and then I get frustrated for doing this. I got to text him.
What was that?
That energy that I wasted was energy I could have spent elsewhere. But it's important to know that there is significance in the period and the question mark and even the exclamation mark, right? When we think about it, there's a significance in the comma, as some of you probably already know. Grandmother really appreciates the comma when it says, "Let's eat, comma, grandma," right? But if you take out the comma, "Let's eat grandma," that's weird in most cultures, especially ours. When we were working on looking at how do we communicate in a few words what the book of Ecclesiastes is all about in a positive way, because it's such a negative, weighty book. It's a book that deals with those corners. How do we say, what does God want us to learn here? And originally, we finally, as Pastor Joe, Zach, and I just wrestled through this, the concept of fulfilled surfaced. Are you finding fulfillment in life? But what happened was is then we had this idea that it was fulfilled question mark. Oh, can you go to the next slide, please? No, that's fine. I just didn't want there we go. All right. I didn't want you guys to dox whoever was on there, right? Which means figure out who they are and then harass them. That's what happens nowadays. So don't put your information out because people will then harass you. But the truth of this series is that the book is about vanity, about this meaninglessness if we're not careful to life. How it can become like a vapor. There is a sense in which that's very true, is that life, there's this grasping after it. It's like water. Every time I try to squeeze and hold on to water, it just slips out of my hand. It's like the smoke that just is rising. It's like wind. And that concept of being fulfilled, how do we as believers find fulfillment? Are you fulfilled? Is it a question mark, which was significant, but then, as I put together the graphic and then got it finished and sent it off to Pastor, he's like, shot me back a note and said, no, we need to change it. It needs to be an exclamation mark because punctuation is important, right? Are you fulfilled? There's a question, and that's a good question to ask. But more so as believers, it's this exclamation mark. I'm finding fulfillment in life. Even this life that I experience where sometimes it's inside that circle where everything makes sense. And when I reap, I sow the things that I reap. But sometimes it's in those edges. It's in the square. It's in the corners of which I experience life and I think this is not the way it should be. Right? And Solomon, as he begins to dig into this passage, of Ecclesiastes chapter 7, he begins to look at a different area because up to this point, he has kind of looked at these certain components, whether it's fame or finances and money and wealth or building and all of that, or even pleasure. He's looked at it all and said there's an emptiness to them. So you need to find enjoyment beyond just that. And then he moves into, and this includes even in wisdom. He talks about wisdom and says, you know what? Well, what good is wisdom if you're going to die? What good is spending all of that time? Because it takes a lot of time. I carry it around with me, not in my pocket, but I'm not going to tell you where, but I carry with me a lot, this silver coin, right? I offered it to two guys. They didn't take my offer, and so they got $5 out of the deal instead of what this coin is worth, right? But it's silver, and it just reminds me that I need to pursue wisdom like silver. There's value in it. There's incredible value in silver and gold, and all throughout the Proverbs, there's this conversation of you need to pursue wisdom in that way. That there's incredible value and worth. But it's hard work. It's harder work to mine through the Scriptures and look through the Scriptures and begin to wrestle through what is it actually saying here. And so as Solomon gets to Ecclesiastes 7, you can remember, and most of you know, he wrote most of the Proverbs, and so he really buys into the concept of wisdom, especially the classical or traditional type of wisdom. There are always unintended consequences to the actions that we take, right? There's always an action and then a reaction. With every privilege comes a responsibility. And in that, we know that just makes sense. But what happens when life spills outside of that context, when it kind of comes at us in a way that we didn't expect? How do I know how to better my life? How do you know how to better your life? Any wise person will tell you that wisdom is more than just cause and effect, that sort of mentality. It can be less predictable than we would like. In order for wisdom to be wise, it must not avoid the particular difficult questions of life. It must handle the practical and speculative, those portions of life that are in the corner, that are on the fringes, that are on the edges. I want to read through Ecclesiastes 7, 1 through 14, and then we're going to spend some time looking at various verses and making sense of what Solomon has to say. Chapter 7, verse 1. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for this is the end of all mankind, that the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of the mourning, and the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the songs of fool. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of fools. This is also vanity. Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the heart of fools. Say not, why were the former days better than these? For this is not wisdom that you this is not from wisdom that you ask of this. Wisdom is good and with an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, and the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves life of him who has it. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful, and in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that men may not find out anything that will be after him. Let me just pray real quick. Dear Lord, I just thank you for your word, and as challenging as it could be sometimes to unpack it, I pray that you would give us clarity, that you would speak into our hearts and into our lives, that you would minister to our spirits and our souls, that your spirit would speak directly and specifically to the things that each one of us individually needs to work on, that we need to grow in to experience a better life, the life that you intend, the life that you plan. And in that process, Lord, I pray that you would help us to trust you as sovereign, even in the midst of the storm, even in the midst of those corner moments of life in which it doesn't make sense. Help us to trust you. I pray this in your son's name. Amen. Number one, and this is something that's important, but and something that you may need to be reminded of, is that a reputation is built over a lifetime and destroyed in a moment. Now we know that, but it's funny how often it happens. Even though I know it, I do things that will destroy my reputation. Right? He says in Ecclesiastes 7:1, a good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death better than the day of birth. Right? So there's this elevation of reputation, this elevation of the thing that people remember you by is incredibly important. What's amazing is that the more experiences you have and shared experiences that you have with people is that, the better sense they get of who you are. So your reputation begins to precede you, right? And the more that you do with them and rub shoulders with them, the more they will come to know you, right? So when you do make mistakes, and we're all bound to make mistakes and screw up royally, is that they will be able to say, nope, that's an exception to the rule of his life. Right? That is an exception to the way that she normally operates. Right? And so there's that sense in which the more experiences that you share with other people will allow for the imperfection of humanity, or the fact that we fail on occasion. Right? There's that brokenness that is within us. And a good name is really not just I do something one time, right? But it's actually the sum total of all of my experiences and my shared experiences. People know my name by all of the things that we have shared and done together, right? Charlene listens to the words that I say, and she remembers me, and even whenever she remembers, by all of our shared experiences, right? All the ways in which I failed and grew and fail and grew, and God worked and shaped me into the person that I am right now. And there's going to be more failures in the future. But oftentimes, too, is that she's witnessing my responses to those. You know, and along with that, she's also witnessing and participating in that experience of life where she starts to see who the real person is. Some of us, we limit our experiences with other people because we don't want them to know the real, you know, the real person, right? And we're scared of that, right? We don't know why we rage on the inside, but we don't want people to know. And so we limit that because I can, for a short time, I can put on I can keep my best foot forward and I can put on a false front, but eventually that comes down, right? Or someone, you know, we do the same sorts of things because we know we have these internal struggles, but we don't want to admit that. And the danger is that we can come to church and we put on a false front, because, well, we know that people in this setting aren't, you know, when they ask how I'm doing, oftentimes they just want a really nice, polite fiction answer, right? You know, and there's occasions where that happens, but if you're giving that answer even to your best friends or those that are closest to you when you feel like garbage, you say, no, it's fine. Well, that's when the polite fiction actually becomes a lie, right? And they often know that you're not fine, right? I know because of how much experience I've had with my brother, is that I know when he's not doing well. He doesn't have to actually say it. And some of you can speak to that, even think of the relationships, those significant relationships that you've had, in which they have, you read and you're able to read that, and you kind of know even what they do. Their reputation becomes an expression of who they are. In fact, their name is this, like, condensed version of all those experiences, right? So when you hear Pastor Zach, there's this condensed experience, this condensed story of all those shared experiences. And that's true for us. And Solomon wants to remind us that reputation is built. And it takes a long time, but it can be destroyed so quickly, right? The day of death is like the day of birth. He transitions into this idea of really, there's this reputation that actually precedes even our life. So there's our lifespan, but our reputation, our legacy goes beyond that. It's important to be reminded of that. Wisdom in Ecclesiastes 7:11. So later on in this passage, he says this: wisdom is good with an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. There's something that gets handed down as we think about just our reputation and the impact of that. And more so, you think about those cultures and really as a whole in our nation, is that there's if you were to average out the median income of certain people groups, Asians are the highest, and then whites, and then blacks, and then Hispanics. And so there's this progression. I may be flipping around the bottom two. But part of that is a reflection of, you think about Asian culture and how there is this investment into the future generations. And some of that is played back where the children are also honoring their parents. But there's that very true reality of, is that my reputation, not just wealth, inheritance can be wealth, but it's something that's more than that. It's so much more than that. And Solomon is spending time dealing with that to remind us that even in the midst of the corners of our life, is there are important things to do. There are important responses, the way that we actually interact with other people. And much like wisdom, is that there is this source of who I am. There's this person that is who I am mostly. But on occasion, I act in those corners, right? I act in the outside peripheral that actually is different than what you would know me as. And so you would think, huh, that's not the Bernie that I know. And you've probably had those experiences with friends and family. And usually you just take it in stride. It's important to invest in that. There's an old Jewish saying that says this: the goodness of life lasts only for a few days, but the goodness of a name lasts forever. And my encouragement to you is to spend the days that God has given you in this life to invest in that name that's going to last forever. And as believers, we know that name isn't Bernie. It isn't even my family name, Gorsuch, but it's Christ. Do I invest in the name of Christ? Do I invest my life into the name of Jesus? And so we gather on a Sunday morning, one, as a reflection, a way to give praise and honor and glory to that name that we're living for, that is going to provide an inheritance that is beyond our imagination. But also throughout the week, how are you investing and in embracing that name? How are you living for that name? Number two, it's important that we take a long view of life, no matter how short it may be. Take a long view of life, no matter how short it would be. In Ecclesiastes verse 2, it is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. This is not what we like to hear. It doesn't make sense. But all of us know, and some of us have experienced in a very real way that the beauty of going to a memorial service of someone who's lived their life for the Lord, or has lived their life for the people around them, for their family, and they've invested in. And there's a celebration in those moments, as sad as it can be, as challenging as it can be, and as heartbreaking as it can be, is that there's that moment where we go into that place as believers and we know this is not the end. But what's amazing about memorial services and funerals is that it helps give us a perspective on how short life is. And by short, that could be 120 years. That's short in comparison to eternity. But some of us have shorter lives. There was a young man named Plus. That was his nickname. And I used to work with him at the Olive Garden, and he was a busser, and he had incredible energy. Was an Asian boy of 19 or 21, I think. No, he was 19. Well, so he got into an accident. He was racing. He was into the, into souping up the cars and making them really fast. And he was racing, and he lost control and slid his car underneath a semi that was parked. But it went right underneath and just, ended his life. And he used to go to my brother's old church at the time down in Southside Baptist. And so they had a huge memorial service there. All of his friends, all of these people that are from the world that weren't believers, but really good friends with Plus, who lived his life investing in other people. He really lived his life well in one respect. And you could see that. At this memorial service, there were all of these people were sharing of how he invested his life into other people. And, because he also, there was that friendship, and I had some significant friendships. And I went up there and I actually shared this verse here. He said, it is actually a good thing to spend time in that type of house, because it helps us give perspective. It helps us to recognize, okay, so what do I do with my life? If I need to number my days, as it says in the Psalms, right? Psalms 90:12, that God calls us to number our days and to make sense and make them matter for Christ, make them matter for those people that we care about. And to go into a house of mourning, it helps remind me that I've only got a short time here. Each one of us are in that same spot. And so it can be somber, but it can also be this moment of, I have a purpose to fulfill. I have a calling to pursue. And so I'm going to do that. I'm going to invest my time. I'm going to stop binge watching modern houses. Right? I'm going to stop doing that. Why? Because it's not that important. Right? I'm not going to have a house like that. But we can get so caught up in the distractions of life and the escape of life that we forget to live life. And Plus lived life well. But he was just off a little bit. See, he grew up in that church at Southside. And he went to Awana at that church. And he memorized scripture, just like our kids memorize scripture, and just like you were memorizing every monthly verse that we have. Thank you. I knew you would. I was totally rebuked last Sunday when Pastor needed my help, and I couldn't help him. I've been working on catching up, and I got behind. That's an excuse, I will admit. But it was one that I will try my best not to not to mess up in the future. Part of his life, though, he had begun so well, and then he had gotten distracted, doing things that he wanted to do, doing things that weren't going to last for eternity, and then his life ended. And I don't know if he's saved or not, but his best friend, who spoke at the funeral, was a Muslim who didn't know Jesus. And you think about in those moments, how do we use even those moments in which I have this hobby and I have this other hobby and you have this thing that you like to do? How do we use that and redeem that and make that a space where we're on mission for Christ, sharing his name? How do we take a long view of even those moments of life, whether it's gardening or Seahawks or boating or whatever it might be? How can we gain a larger, longer view of life? Because wisdom helps us do that, but more so getting into those moments where we just have to face our own mortality. And we need to be thankful for our own mortality. And I'll tell you why. If God had allowed Adam and Eve to enter back into the garden and eat from the tree of life, we would be forever in this predicament of broken sinfulness. Right? And so he guarded that tree so that we would die. And so that we would be raised to new life. There are friends that we miss, and it's okay. It's okay to cry. It's okay to mourn. But it's important as believers to say, I still have a life to live. And so there's that somberness and there's that moment of just recognizing, I'm going to miss that guy. I'm going to miss that person. I'm going to miss my mom. I'm going to miss my dad. I'm going to miss my grandma. I'm going to miss that loved one. But as believers, we won't miss them for long. Take a long view, no matter how short life may be. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning, as Solomon says in verse 8. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. There's a transition there. Oftentimes, the long view of life helps us to put things into perspective. I'm reminded of these experiences with my dad in which I'm doing something that he reminds me not to do, and then I do it again, and I'm actually breaking tools of his. And he's so kind. And what's interesting is that over the years, and I didn't realize it at the moment, but I've looked back on those experiences, and I realized my dad has taken the long view of that. See, he could erupt and he could get mad at me for not listening to what he had just told me to do, and I didn't do it, and I broke a tool. But he realized if I tear into my son, then I might have to pay for counseling later on, right? So the $100 for the new drill or whatever is gonna, I don't know how obviously he's thinking in terms of me and not the counseling. But it's significant to take a longer view of stuff. So often when I find myself getting angry at something, it's because I'm just so pinpointed on this. I'm so nearsighted and focused on this one thing. And there have been two occasions in my life. I don't struggle with anger in part because I've gained a bit of the benefit of my dad's inheritance, right? I saw him and caught some of that. But there have been occasions where I've been angry and responded with force. And in those moments, there's a sense in which making sure those moments are exceptions to the rule and not the rule of my life. Because that whole course of ministry, and Kendra can attest to, because she knows of one experience in which that happened, not directed at her, by the way. And vaguely, I don't even think I was that angry, but she, that's fine, I'll take her at her word, is that she also knew the course of the years and years that we did shared ministry. So she knew the kind of person I was. And some of that I learned from my dad. But it's important to be patient, because oftentimes when I get angry, it's because I didn't have all the information. Right? I didn't take time to factor in or to analyze or to reason what I was actually doing. I just was doing. I was responding. See, one of the things that when we go inside the prison is that we talk to these guys that are on the inside, and they are living in the consequence of their actions, right? And there's this kind of this equation. Oh, I'm jumping ahead of myself. I am. Oh, hold that thought. All right, we'll get there later. All right, I don't want to throw Russell under the bus there. But it's important in terms of being patient is that it gives me time to just take a breath and then respond in a way that I would like to respond. Oftentimes, if I'm just reacting, I do things that I regret, and then I have to play cleanup, right? And maybe you can speak of those same experiences in your life. If you haven't had them, you may have them soon. If you have children, then they will help you learn and experience some of that, right? God is going to use that child in your life to help sometimes polish the thing that needs to be polished in your life, or to sand, or maybe even chisel out chunks of who you are that aren't reflections of Christ, right? And so be thoughtful and be patient in those experiences, first asking God, what do you want me to learn in this moment? Yeah, I don't like it. Yeah, it's frustrating. Yeah, he should have listened to me when I told him to set the drill on the ground instead of precariously up here, right? But in those moments, you have to actually take time and ask those questions, because in that you'll act in a way that you won't regret. And then in verse 10, he says this: say not, why were the former days better than these? For this is not from wisdom that you ask of this. Now, I'm guilty of saying, oh, I wish and longing for the good old days. Before a smartphone, before T9 language, before, you know, when my brother had to communicate in full sentences, you know, stuff like that, with question marks included. Right? I'm guilty of that. But Solomon here is saying that that's not actually true. It's not of wisdom that you ask of this. Because back in my good old days, actually, if you go even a few years before that, wars were happening that weren't so good. The world was still dark and ugly and icky, right? And so there's a sense in which I tend to look into our past, and you might tend to look into your past and think, okay, it was all good, but it isn't always the case. Be careful of how your selective memory is. There are two types of fools in this world. The first says, it is old, therefore it is good. And the second says, it is new, therefore it is better. Right? You know, the goodness of something, and if it's better, is based on the quality of what it is. It's not actually the whether or not it's old or new. That old thing that works really well is good because it works really well, not because it's old. Right. Number three, proper responses on the outside will eventually bring deep healing on the inside. In Ecclesiastes, verse 3 and 4 of chapter 7, sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of a wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. That is the house of laughter and party. See, one of our great problems in our society is that there's this increasing inability to deal with disappointment and despair, and even death. How do we handle death if you're just living for this life? Especially when we look at this life and say, okay, there are great things that we are blessed with in this world, and life is good. But there are also challenging things, and if you've invested all of your time and all of your resources into this life, you might have a vacation home that is incredibly expensive and not used, right? But eventually it's going to go by the wayside. Eventually you will hand it to children who won't care about it or not want to go there. You see, there's a longing to feel glad, but there's also this pursuit of trying to get it the quickest way possible. Laughter makes me glad. Sorrow makes me sad. Therefore, I want laughter. And that's it. And the world, there are places to laugh, but oh, there's so much more. And our life has to incorporate all of that. If it doesn't, then it's not going to be as strong and vibrant as it should be. And you won't flourish, because the rain will come and the floods will rise. And your life will be affected by what happens to just about everyone's lives. So how do we sort through that? How do we find an anchor in that? Verse 9 Solomon says this, be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the heart of fools. And this is where this whole idea of how do I respond or how do I react to a situation. A reaction is usually this, immediately. Something happens, immediately I do something. But a response is, okay, what should I do? Not what do I want to do, because I want to retaliate, or I want to put them in this place, or I want to say this, and I want to say that, but what is the most helpful thing to do? A response is different. This, I believe, is where there's another thing. If you want to advance the slide, yes. With the guys in the prison, we will share, there's an event that you have in your life, and either event plus reaction equals you get what you get, right? That's what you get. If you react to an event, that's what you get. But the other equation is, if there's this event in my life plus my response, that's going to equal getting what I want. You see, if all I do in my life and if all you do in your life is just react to life coming at you, and that's it, then you're going to, well, that's what you get. You get what you get. But if you begin to learn to respond, you begin to shape life, and God, it's through the grace of God that that happens, is that we begin to shape life in a way that I will eventually get the things that I want. Number four, listen to words you need to hear and not just what you want to be said. Listen to the words that you need to hear and not just the words that you want to be said. It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the songs of fools. For as a crackling of thorns under the pot, so is the laughter of the fools. This is also vanity. My question for you, and I want to get through this pretty quickly, is how do you take criticism? How do I take criticism? Hard words can be kind, and kind words can be cruel. And what I mean by this is, so let's say I've been working on running. I'm really good at running, right? And someone comes along and they're like, oh man, you're running really good. Your form is great and you're really fast. And I'm like, oh yeah, check this out. There was this kid one time at the Olive Garden and he said, oh yeah, I got some new shoes. I'm really fast. And I'm like, oh really? How fast? I was expecting him to like run a distance. He was like this. I'm like, that's pretty fast right there. And but so let's say I've been working on my running and I'm running and someone comes along and they say, man, you're running really good. Your form is excellent. You're very fast. But then someone else comes along and says, you're running really fast towards a cliff. But I don't want to listen to the cliff because I'm focused on my form. I'm running really good, and it's a slight downhill, so it makes me appear even faster. But I don't want to listen to the person that's telling me that I'm running towards something that's going to destroy my life. So what happens is that people will, those that are exhorting or rebuking you for the right reasons, that love you and care about you, are going to speak hard words into your life. But those hard words are sources of kindness. It's the person that says, oh no, you're great at running. Keep doing what you're doing. They're saying kind words, but those words are actually going to be cruel because you're running into a wall or off a cliff. The words that you hear, you first have to ask the question of the person, right? The question of whether or not the quality of person telling you the words is important. Does this person love me? Do they care about me? If they do and if they're wise, then I should accept the words no matter how hard they are. It's easy to accept kind words, nice words. It's another thing to accept hard words. It's another thing to actually speak hard words. Who likes conflict? I will tell you this. The person that likes conflict isn't that great at exhortation. Right? Because most people know they don't care about them. They just care about the truth. They just care about putting someone in their place. And it's important to know that there are times where I need to be put in my place, and there are times that you need encouragement and rebuke. Respond well to those that are rebuking you and turn from the ways from running towards that cliff. Number five, true wisdom must have an element of riddles, puzzles, and mystery. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? Ecclesiastes 7:13. There are things in life that we can't straighten out, that we can't sort out, that aren't in that circle of practical wisdom. That's just outside on the fringes. There's those things that God has made crooked, and I don't know why, but it's an opportunity for me in my life to say, I'm going to trust you, God, who is sovereign over my life in this moment of my life. I don't know what you're trying to do, but I need to trust you. As little Joe Parkinson has to trust his parents, it's much better for him on the outside than on the inside. Now, it's safer on the inside, but pretty soon he's got to come out. And did. And he's in those moments where he's learning trust. And maybe you're in that moment in life where you're still learning to trust the Lord. In that storm of your life, in that corner of your life. And there's going to be more moments. And so I hope you learn to travel that path well and often. That you will trust him and that your wisdom will incorporate this sense of mystery. That there are things that I can't understand, but I trust the Lord. And so he says in verse 14, in the day of prosperity, be joyful, and in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. See, there's certain truths in Scripture that aren't revealed. It's the Word of God. It is true, as God wanted to reveal himself to us, but it's limited. Because the infinite God of the universe, who controls everything, whose kingdom is so far beyond us, he had to reveal himself in language that limits him. But that adequate language reveals him in truth. But there are things that you will never know. There are things that I will never know. And even as I study and even as I dig in and try to figure it out, there's a process in which God grows me in that, but I'll never know. The truth of this last point is important to take and to remember, is that there's a puzzle and there's a mystery and there's a riddle to life that I have to embrace, that you have to embrace and to say, you know what, okay, I'm not going to have an answer, but I'm going to keep pressing on. I can't figure this all out, but I know that God is true and trustworthy. I'm going to keep doing the things that I know I should do. I'm going to keep planting the corn, even if sometimes something else comes up. But I'm going to keep doing that. I'm going to be faithful with that. I'm going to be faithful with that. I'm going to be faithful with that. I don't know what God is going to do, but I look forward to what God is going to do through our building program. As he opens doors, as he is already laying the foundations, as he's preparing buyers for the ministry center and all of that, it is exciting. But we're called to be faithful, to keep planting and keep planting and keep planting. And to water and water and water. And then let God work out the harvest. There are things that we won't know, and we have to trust him. There are struggles that we will face, and we have to trust him. There are limitations to our wisdom, but in those moments, we have to trust him. Otherwise, life is unbearable. And it's so good when we walk life with the Lord. We're going to sing a song to end the service. Thank you for listening, and the men will come forward and do the offering as well. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Courtney. Why don't you stand?